This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Today we're talking about conspiracies and misinformation surrounding the COVID-19 virus and the government's response to the pandemic. If you have questions or comments on our show today, we would love to hear from you. We are on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, or you can leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. We would love to hear your voice in today's conversation. Again, call 866-476-3881 with a quick question or comment. Joining me now are two guests. Tom Dzinski is Director of Epidemiology Education at the Richard M. Fairbanks School of Public Health at IUPUI. Good to have you back, Tom.
Nice to be back, Matt. Thanks for the opportunity.
Joanne Miller is Associate Professor of Political Science and International Relations at the University of Delaware. Welcome to you, Joanne.
Thanks, Matt. Thanks for having me.
So, Joanne, we'll start with you, and we're talking today about conspiracy theories and misinformation, so two things that overlap in some ways, but also have some distinct characteristics. So let's start with the basic definition. What is a conspiracy theory?
Yeah, so social scientists define conspiracy theories as the belief that a powerful group of people, and it's always more than one person, are conspiring, working behind the scenes, engaging in sort of secret, illegal or ambiguously legal actions that are typically thought of to be sort of to benefit themselves or benefit their friends or other people in their immediate group. So key is secret plot, more than one person. And they're very hard. They're not falsifiable in a lot of respects.
Yeah. And so this basic idea that a powerful group would secretly plan and execute on something for their own benefit, I guess, is in and of itself not a crazy idea. It's happened a lot throughout history, but it seems like the phrase today is typically assigned to a certain kind of explanation, and it definitely carries a negative connotation for a lot of people. Why do you think that is?
Yeah, so that's an important point, is that there have been real conspiracies that have been found out in the United States and in the world. And conspiracy theory itself has become a negative phrase that we use to, and conspiracy theorist is a negative connotation that we throw out to people to delegitimize their ideas. And so we have to be careful here that when we talk about conspiracy theories, we really are meaning sort of this not falsifiable belief that there's this secret plot. And what I mean by not falsifiable is that any piece of information that you can provide that would be sort of counter to that theory is always turned around as being part of the theory itself. See, that's how deep this thing goes. But some conspiracy theories end up becoming conspiracies when there's enough proof that the thing occurred. And so there's that fine line there.
And so, Tom, when we're talking about something that affects everyone like this, and we're also talking about something that has to do with science, which is not always, science changes all the time. It has to. That's part of the scientific method. Scrutiny is important to the scientific method, but that can be perverted in a way. We want to focus on conspiracies and information that have really had an impact during the pandemic, of course, today, and that seem to be influencing a significant number of people. What are some specific ideas that have had the most impact based on what you've seen?
That's, you know, the whole idea of like wearing masks, not wearing masks, certainly is playing out right now. And some of the, you know, ideas behind that are challenging our ability to control this disease. Right? We know that wearing masks aren't essentially protecting you from other people. It's protecting other people from you, because we know the science now. After studying this disease, after doing several studies, that up to 40% of the people that are infected may be asymptomatic, right? They have no signs or symptoms whatsoever. So if in fact you are infected and have no signs and symptoms, you're still able to spread that. And wearing a mask will help protect other people from you. So that's one of the challenges we've had lately is, you know, if everyone else is wearing a mask, why do I need to? Well, it's this idea that you might be the infected person and not even know it.
And on masks, some of the ideas that I've seen come with, I guess, direct quotes from Anthony Fauci, who early on in the pandemic said, I don't anticipate seeing people wearing masks. And at that time, he has since said he doesn't regret saying that because at the time, the pandemic, I guess, wasn't at a state where we really should have been doing that. Or perhaps at the time, the science that we knew at that time said it wouldn't have an effect or would have less of an effect. What do we know about that time and the commentary on masks?
Right. Absolutely. That's a really good point. Early on, it's, you know, the idea of, well, we don't need to wear masks. And I think that came exactly with the idea of how this disease is mostly transmitted. We believe, you know, that fomites, which are inanimate objects that can harbor disease, like, you know, touching doorknobs and common surfaces and then rubbing our eyes or nose and such, could actually transmit the disease. We see this with influenza. We see it with other diseases as well. As we learned more about this new virus, we recognized that respiratory droplets are the primary source of transmission, not the only, but the primary, where most people are going to get infected is through respiratory droplets and this asymptomatic transmission that I talked about earlier, right? So the mask went from not being maybe necessary in every situation to our one of our primary modes of protection at this point.
And I'm sure that we're going to talk
more about the science as we learn more about it, then the mask became essential.
I'm sure we're going to talk more about masks this hour, but Joanne, I want to get back to you. Why are people drawn to conspiracy theories? Is it a purely psychological sense?
Is largely psychological. There's a political component too, but the largely psychological component is about uncertainty and powerlessness and feeling a loss of control. And during a pandemic, it's a perfect storm of uncertainty, loss of control, and powerlessness. And when we feel uncertain, we look to try to find explanations. That's a natural thing that we all do. We want to understand our world because if we understand our world, we're able to affect the things that we want in that world. We're able to operate within that world effectively. And so when a scary thing happens that makes us feel uncertain or powerlessness, we seek out explanations. And conspiracy theories are one form of an explanation that some people can sort of cling to as a way to gain back some control or gain back some certainty. And to Tom's discussion about masks, the science has evolved and we know more about COVID than we did before. And that sort of what people are pointing to is that, you know, they were telling us no masks and now they're telling us masks, is an unfortunate sort of side effect of the public seeing the sausage being made, the science sausage being made as it's happening, because there's some component of then uncertainty that people are looking for explanations. And so it may seem odd to say that a conspiracy theory can make us feel better, but if it helps us to explain a situation and in a way that enables us to regain some certainty, then people will cling to them.
Can you explain what motivated reasoning or confirmation bias means and how it works?
Yeah. So motivated reasoning, again, it's something that we all engage in. And it's the basic idea that when we're seeking out information in order to make a decision, if we already have a preconceived notion of the decision that we kind of want to end up making, we'll seek out information, we'll filter information in a way that gets us to the place that we wanted to be to begin with. So if I'm looking to buy a car and I have this idea that I want a Honda, I'll end up getting a Honda because I'll end up only sort of finding information that confirms my belief that the Honda is the best car for me to buy. And so if I'm looking for information about the pandemic and maybe why it is occurring. We can talk about the 5G conspiracy theory in this regard.
Oh, goodness, yes.
But yes, I'll draw this out. So if I'm looking for where this virus came from and how I can control it and what I can do, and I see, oh, look, there's this map that shows that all the places where the hotspots of the virus are tend to be the places that have 5G towers. Look, there's a relationship there, and now I'm thinking that that's a causal relationship. Part of this confirmation bias or motivated reasoning is I'm looking for a causal explanation. So I'm going to find one when one doesn't exist. It's like connecting dots that shouldn't be connected. And instead of noticing, oh, those happen to be where all the people live, and that's the reason for the 5G towers and the reason for the virus hotspots, I say, oh, look, those things are causally connected, and 5G towers must be causing the virus. And look, I can fight a tower. I can't fight a virus that I can't see, but I can read the information about 5G towers, and that can help you gain some control over a situation that's scary and uncontrollable.
Do we have an idea of how common certain conspiratorial beliefs are about the pandemic? Is there good data on it?
There is. Certainly in the U.S., data that I've collected, there are a variety of conspiracy theories about the origins of the disease, of the virus, whether it's a Chinese biological weapon, for example. In my data, 30% of the U.S. population believe that it was probably created by China's biological weapon. 19% say that it was definitely created by China's biological weapon. So add those two up, you got 49% who are willing to entertain the possibility that it's a Chinese biological weapon. 5G towers, it's about 22% think that it's probably or definitely the case that 5G towers are spreading the virus. Thankfully, it's a very small percentage who believe the virus is a hoax, but still 8% say it's probably or definitely not real at all. So there's definitely a range, but there are quite a few of these conspiracy theories out there.
We'll be back with our guests after a quick break talking about conspiracies and misinformation surrounding the COVID-19 pandemic. And if you have questions or comments for the show, we're on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, or leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. 866-476-3881. We'd love to hear from you this hour. I'm Matt Pelser. We are back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Today we're talking about conspiracies and misinformation surrounding the COVID-19 pandemic. And we would love your questions and comments on the topic. We are on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, or you can leave us a voicemail with your first name and where you're calling from at 866-476-3881. 866-476-3881. We would love to hear from you this hour. We have with us Tom Tuszynski, Director of Epidemiology Education at the Richard M. Fairbanks School of Public Health at IUPUI, and Joanne Miller, Associate Professor of Political Science and International Relations at the University of Delaware. So, Joanne, we were talking about conspiracy theories and how they can happen and why they spread. And you gave me some really, really sobering numbers. 30% of people surveyed believe that it is probably a Chinese biological weapon. 19% believe it is definitely a Chinese biological weapon, adding up to a potential 49% based on the sample of the entire U.S. population, would you say, or respondents?
The survey is, I want to be careful here, it's not a nationally representative sample, but it's weighted to be nationally representative.
Gotcha.
So the sample is about 4,000 respondents. So it's close to a national, so it's not particularly precise to say 49% of the U.S. population, but certainly 49% of the 4,000 people I surveyed, and that 4,000 is close to a nationally representative.
Goodness. There are a lot of big consequential things that happen in the world, but not all of them attract conspiracy theories on the scale that we're seeing right now. What is it about the pandemic that seems to encourage it?
Yep. So I think two things. One, I keep referring to this as a perfect storm, and it is with regard to uncertainty. These health issues are scary because they are life and death. And the response, in part, that has also affected people in terms of employment and switching. It's basically has been a life-changing, life-affecting all aspects of life for many people for some months now. And so in a sense, I would say that the uncertainty and the powerlessness is kind of ramped up in this regard. But the other side of this is also political. In the U.S. in particular, President Trump is being soundly criticized for his handling of the pandemic. And so if we want to talk about motivated reasoning again, people who voted for President Trump and who support President Trump are looking for explanations for why maybe he's being criticized, and looking towards conspiracy theories around, oh, well, the virus isn't, the media or scientists are exaggerating the virus and the seriousness of it in order to make the president look bad. And so then again, that's sort of another sort of kind of, I want to call it sort of natural, but a political desire that we all have to have our worldviews confirmed and our beliefs confirmed. And so right now it happens to be that a Republican president is being criticized. And so it tends to be Republicans in the U.S. who are more likely to believe these conspiracy theories, especially if they're feeling particularly uncertain. So it's that sort of combination of those things.
Yeah, it can seem like conspiracy theories are particularly partisan right now, but I think that anyone could really be susceptible to them, despite their political leanings. We have a listener voicemail from Chris. Let's listen to that now.
Hi, this is Chris. I'm calling from Westfield. I think one of the biggest feeders of conspiracy theories and issues around misunderstandings around COVID in Indiana is mostly just a misunderstanding of how science works. Because we've learned so much since the virus got here, like how to treat it better, and in hindsight, we look at how we treated people with COVID before and we see that we did it wrong, people kind of throw up their hands and they're like, oh, nobody knows what they're doing, or it's taken us a while to figure out how to collect the data well or get our models right. And as we learn more and as we go, we get more accurate, but we take the data that we learn now and we look back at the data that we had before and we think, oh, everyone was wrong before and the experts were lying to us. And I think it just comes down to a fundamental misunderstanding of how science is kind of a learn-as-you-go process, and that's getting kind of conflated with the idea that the scientists were giving us bad information. And I just think that misunderstanding is underlying a lot of fuel behind conspiracy thinking or other stuff.
Thank you so much for that, Chris. Tom, this has so much to do with the scientific method, and going back to something that was said earlier about scrutiny being an absolutely essential part of it and how science corrects itself.
That's 100% correct, right? I mean, we're talking about something that's never been seen before in the human population and trying to understand it and provide information so that the public can protect themselves, right? We all want, as Joanne was indicating, right, we want some sense of control, and we want our scientists, we want our doctors, we want our public health officials to give us some information that will allow us to feel like we're in control, that we can control our exposure to this and an outcome, right? But the challenge here is when you have something brand new, we don't know all the aspects of that. We are still learning as much as we can about this virus. And hopefully that we'll learn enough to create a vaccine or have an effective treatment in the near future.
We have a question now from Jimmy on Facebook who says, I've heard the term truth seekers applied to those who are questioning the pandemic, government responses to it, and of course, vaccines. Who adopts this identity and how do listeners react to this term? For me, it seems like a term that captures the moral high ground. After all, who would question seeking the truth? Joanne, a lot of conspiracy theories like to say that they're just asking questions, sort of as a defense as to why they might bring up something that may seem to some people as outlandish. Is that a common defense?
It is. And in fact, the truth seeker label is sort of the counter to the conspiracy theorist label, right? Conspiracy theorist has a negative connotation. Truth seeker has a positive connotation. And there is some truth to the idea, right? Especially in a democracy, we want people to question government. We want people to hold government accountable. And in fact, some would argue that it's the people who don't believe any conspiracy theories who are the ones we should be studying, because there's something wrong with them if they believe everything that they hear, and that this notion of truth seeking and questioning is a positive in a representative democracy. Where it gets twisted, I think, is then when that truth seeking becomes, I have now found the truth, I'm going to close off my mind to anything beyond that. Right? And so it becomes truth-seeking up until I feel like I found the truth, and then I'm not going to be open to any alternative arguments that maybe my truth isn't accurate.
Tom, I want to go back to this idea that that the virus was created. So setting aside for a moment the credibility and the plausibility of that, that it was created and intentionally spread, is it even possible for something like that to happen? Could a novel virus like COVID-19 be created in a lab?
It's really hard to do. And usually if you want to do something like that, you can't just create a virus out of thin air, right? You need some sort of what we would call a backbone virus, some virus that already exists that we would have to manipulate to the point where it would create a new infection, something that hasn't been seen in the population before. All right, so step one, that's really, really difficult to do. If you did it that way, we would be able to detect that backbone virus, right, that original virus, when we did the genetic sequencing of that, and say, okay, yes, we know for certain now that this was created because it originally started out as some other virus that was manipulated. Really, really hard to do, and to get it to what we would call a pandemic level, where you have this novel virus, you have increased morbidity and mortality, and you have person-to-person transmission, ongoing sustained person-to-person transmission. Those are really complex issues in public health. So looking at this one, when the genetic sequence came out of COVID-19, they didn't find any backbone virus, right? They saw this as a merging of what appears to be animal origin, bats and pangolins, and a pangolin is kind of like an armadillo, and which were present in this live market in China, and human viruses, right? And we know that can happen. We see it all the time with influenzas, right? We see human influenza viruses merging with avian or bird flus, right, and creating something new. We see it merging with swines. In this situation, we have a coronavirus that was probably a bat or pangolin origin merged with a human virus, and we created a pandemic. And that sounds a little far-fetched, but think about this. We've had more than 40 new diseases that have emerged in the human population since the 1970s, right? So this is part of evolution. And when you mix people with animals, you're going to have these types of situations.
How much of a challenge, Tom, is it to debunk all these conspiracy theories and bits of misinformation with science, especially if something is so hypothetical that you can't really test for it and show the results?
Yeah, it's really challenging. And, you know, as I tell my students, as I tell others, I said, where are you getting your data from, right? That's, you know, are we looking at true scientific peer-reviewed data? And recognizing that a lot of studies are going on and the data may change over time, as it has with COVID-19, or what we've learned has changed over time, and staying up to date on that. So that's that's the first thing that people can do is arm themselves with good information from reliable sources. You know, some of the social media sites some of the non-peer-reviewed sites aren't necessarily the best source of information and subject to people throwing a conspiracy theory on top of them.
Joanne, how do people steeped in conspiratorial thought typically react when they see evidence that debunks their belief?
So they typically react by engaging in counter-arguing and saying, well, that further is evidence of the conspiracy itself. See how far it goes. So it is really difficult to debunk a conspiracy theory. And I would suggest that it's not that we shouldn't try. And going back to your first caller's comment about understanding science, I think that's an important component here. I used the phrase earlier about seeing how the sausage is made. People are seeing in real time how science develops and how it changes in response to new data, and they don't typically see that at this kind of scale. And so that's important. But I would also argue that part of the tricky thing about debunking conspiracy theories is that if they're serving a purpose for people, if they're serving the purpose of helping people to feel a little bit more control or a little less powerless, then there's always another conspiracy theory out there that they can grab onto if you've debunked this one, but they're still left feeling uncertain. What I find in my data with regard to COVID-19 conspiracy theories is that they're all highly correlated with one another. People who believe one tend to believe multiple conspiracy theories, some of them that are even contradictory to one another. Because they're all serving the same purpose. And so potentially things like helping people to understand the scientific process and feel more certain about the effectiveness of peer review, the effectiveness of scientific trials can be helpful here. But trying to pick apart any individual conspiracy theory is difficult for the reasons that Tom mentioned and the psychological purposes that they serve.
We have a listener voicemail from Marion. Let's listen.
Hi, I'm Marion, and I'm calling from Fincastle, Indiana. And I'm wondering about those who believe that the IG Towers are the China's biological weapons and these hoaxes. If it would not help if we told the true etiology of this virus comes down to misuse of animals in some way or other. It seems like the swine flu, corporate agriculture, and those are who want to convince us that meat, dairy, and eggs are essential and not causing more harm than good, are doing all they can to trace it back that, you know, we are misusing animals and creating horrible diseases by our livestock industry. Thank you.
Tom, how should we respond to Marion?
Yeah, that's the misuse of animals, I'm not sure is the appropriate term here. So if when we think about these live markets in China, this is a livelihood for a lot of people that raise animals for, you know, primary sources of protein. And in certain situations, if you think about, you know, if you had to butcher these animals and properly refrigerate them and then get them to market and people have to get them home in packaging and keep them cold, that takes a lot of resources, right? I mean, that's really challenging. It's so much easier to bring live animals to market in cages so that I don't have to refrigerate. I don't have to necessarily maintain certain hygiene standards, right? And those are the situations that create problems, because when you bring animal species together, whether we're talking humans and other animal species, that's when we start to see these viruses maybe combining in populations. In the U.S., the situation is a little bit different. We have different resources to, you know, easily get to a market and purchase our food already butchered and cleaned and everything like that. So to me, it's more about the necessity of getting protein to populations, and the easiest, cheapest way to do that is using live animals.
Thanks for that, Tom, and thanks, Marion, for your question. I'm having a little trouble with my audio here, but so Joanne, in our last minute in this segment, is there an especially effective way to persuade people that a baseless claim shouldn't be believed? Are there certain tactics that work best?
So a couple of quick ones. First of all, calling someone a crazy conspiracy theorist is not going to work.
No.
Right? derogating and calling someone a nut is not an effective strategy. And as much as you might want to call somebody a crazy conspiracy theorist, it doesn't work. And crazy isn't part of the equation here. Approaching somebody with empathy and with the tone of let's have a conversation about this. Well, I'll read that source. Would you read a source as well? Asking people questions. Where did that information come from? Well, is that the only source that is reporting that? I wonder why only one source would report it.
There's a lot more to talk about. We'll keep it going after a quick break. We're talking today about conspiracies and misinformation surrounding the COVID-19 pandemic. I'm Matt Pelser. We are back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Today, we are talking about conspiracies and misinformation surrounding the COVID-19 pandemic. We would love your questions and comments for the show today. We're on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, or you can leave us a short voicemail with your first name and where you're calling from at 866-476-3881. 866-476-3881. Tom, we talked a little bit about masks earlier. I definitely want to come back to that. You talked a little bit about the effectiveness of masks in general, but what about different kinds of masks? A lot of people have cloth masks, myself included. Do they work just as well? How much variance is there?
There is some variance, but I think the message here is that anything that will keep those droplets and those air particles in your vicinity is what we're looking for, right? We don't want those kind of moving through the environment because that we know is one of the primary modes of transmission for coronavirus. So we know that the masks that are tight-fitting over your face, including your nose and, you know, go all the way under your chin, that don't have a lot of gaps, are the best. You know, if you have several layers of cloth in that mask or fabric of some sort, those are the best. We don't want the ones that have the little valve on them because what that does is just push the air out. That's not, which includes the virus with it. So we're trying to avoid those. But any face covering at this point is better than none.
What's the most common misinformation about masks that you see lately?
I think some of the most common misinformation is that it's going to protect me from other people. And that's not necessarily the case. The mask is there to protect other people from you. And the fact that everybody has to wear a mask in order for this to be effective, right? If only half the people wear masks or the most vulnerable wear masks, that's not going to bend the curve, if you will, or slow the spread of this virus, right? It's everybody has to wear it in those situations where we can't maintain proper physical distancing, especially indoors.
Joanne, some research has been done on face masks and the people who don't believe in their efficacy. What have we learned from that?
So I think that, you know, that there are probably the same sort of, there's probably a relationship, although I can't say this for sure, between believing in conspiracy theories about COVID-19 and the choice not to wear masks or not to engage in other self-protective and other protective measures that public health officials are saying are essential here. And the connection is that if you believe the virus isn't as serious as people are saying it is, or if you're willing to believe all sorts of other conspiracy theories about the virus, believing that masks are some insidious way to control us is another one of those things that we can believe, and it's obviously not true. And I think that the information needs to get out there about the purpose of masks and why the recommendation is to wear them and the necessity of wearing them is important, again, to help sort of make people feel more certain about the necessity here.
Tom, one semi-prevalent conspiracy theory that we've seen and that we talked a little bit about already this hour is that 5G, a new wireless technology, is either spreading the virus or making people more vulnerable to it. Can you explain the idea behind this? What do people think is happening?
So, you know, it's not very...
Well, go ahead.
Okay, go ahead, Tom.
Sorry, please. You start. No, I think...
Sorry, there's a bad delay on the line. So, Tom, go right ahead.
So the virus itself, I mean, this is a respiratory virus. There are a lot of coronaviruses out there. There are some that are more prevalent in humans than others. And where we're at right now is that we have a human coronavirus that is spreading person to person, and we don't longer need these animals involved, right? This is a natural disease process, and it's part of evolution. The emergence of 5G, as Joanne indicated earlier, is purely coincidental, right? And in this situation, this idea that 5G is causing this, there is no science to that. There is no evidence to that. That is purely conjecture and speculation. And it's coincidental. There is no evidence otherwise.
Joanne, I'd love your follow-up on it.
Yeah, I was just going to say the same thing, that if you look at the origins or the discussion of 5G towers causing the virus, there's no explanation of why. There's no, because the virus is spread this way and this is therefore how the 5G towers are spreading it. It's at the level of this connecting dots that shouldn't be connected. Well, 5G towers are around the same places where the virus has been, where the hotspots have been, so therefore it must be. And so there is no, that I've seen in the communications around the conspiracy theory, no sort of evidence or even explanation provided for why 5G towers could spread or exacerbate the virus other than, well, look, these things are happening at the same time, therefore one is causing the other.
We have a listener voicemail now from Rob. Let's listen.
Hello, this is Rob calling from Indianapolis. Thanks for your show. How can you have a rational discussion with someone without labeling them as the crazy conspiratorist? But showing empathy, I like that idea, questioning where their information comes from. Can you give us some more information on that? There's just several people that are stuck with their opinion that this is a conspiracy and it may even be a hoax. And how can we get around that?
Thanks for your voicemail, Rob. Joanne, so many of these discussions are taking place on social media, and there is a disconnect in communication on social media. You can't read visual cues. You can't hear the tone in people's voices. And so that can really change how you take the information from another person. And as we've seen time and time again, feelings can really be hurt. Could that be part of it?
Absolutely. One of the pieces of advice that I would give is that if it's a friend or a family member, someone who you have a personal connection with who may be, you know, linking to conspiracy theories or posting about conspiracy theories online, is to take the conversation offline or at least to take it privately online. Because just like in any discussion or conversation with somebody, nobody likes to be contradicted or pointed out as being wrong. publicly. And there's a lot of face-saving that people engage in a public forum that they may be less likely to do when it's a one-on-one conversation that's more more private. But the other component here, and I think that your caller is right, there are, as in any discussion with someone, even about just any sort of political views where you're trying to change somebody's mind about a political attitude, about a policy position, at some point, there are sometimes when you just have to say, I can't convince this person, and that this conversation can't continue to happen. And especially if it's if it's someone you have a personal relationship, the question of how far do you want to take this? Do you want to potentially risk losing the personal relationship? It may get to that point. And you may have to say, we're going to have to agree to disagree. And you're going to have to, if you're going to keep posting this stuff, I'm going to keep, you know, I'm debunking it. And it may end that way. And some of these will end that way, where it's not possible to change somebody's mind about a particular conspiracy theory.
We're talking today about conspiracy theories and misinformation surrounding the COVID-19 pandemic with Joanne Miller, an associate professor of political science and international relations at the University of Delaware, and Tom Dyszynski, director of epidemiology education at the Richard M. Fairbanks School of Public Health at IUPUI. And Joanne, we got a comment from a listener. Justin wants to know how much data manipulation plays a role in conspiracies gaining traction.
Extent that any of these conspiracy theories involve things like scientists or the media exaggerating the seriousness of the virus, then some of the underlying sort of the mechanism of that conspiracy theory may very well be the belief that the statistics are lying, right? They're lying with statistics, or those numbers are not right, or they're exaggerating the numbers or counting things differently to make the numbers seem bigger than they are. So, some of the underlying mechanism of the conspiracy theory very much could be the way they're doing this is by either manipulating the numbers or lying with the numbers. And again, here's where the communication about how science works can be potentially effective in debunking some of that. But again, it's a lot of what we have to do as adults is trust things that we can't see. And we're not watching the numbers being produced. We're not watching the statistics. Sometimes we don't understand them. And so there's a lot of trust that needs to be involved here, and building that trust and teaching that trust in science.
Tom Dyszynski, are you seeing any common misinformation about a potential vaccine for the virus?
I'm not seeing a whole lot of misinformation about it. I mean, everybody is speculating as to when a vaccine will be available, right? And there's a process to making a vaccine to ensure that it's safe, right? We have to go through what they call phases or clinical trials. And phase one of the clinical trial is it safe for a person to take, right? Is it going to do any harm, right? So we test that in a small group or a small population or people that have volunteered to do this. The second phase then is, does it work? Does it actually do what we say it's going to do, which is produce an immune response to the disease that we're after? And again, this is done in a larger population or a larger group of people that have volunteered to do that. And then phase three, which is where we're at with several vaccines right now, is let's vaccinate even more people and see what the outcome is. Are they getting infected? Are they producing this immune response to the vaccine? Right? Are they still healthy? If we get through those three phases, then we could release it into the general public. But even then, the science doesn't stop, right? We still monitor the vaccine's effectiveness in a larger population. So it's not so much the fact that there's conspiracy theories around the vaccines. It's more about how soon can we produce a vaccine. And in this situation, it takes time to ensure that the vaccine is safe before we just release it to the general public.
Of course, the news came out earlier this week that Russia announced that they had a vaccine ready and that Vladimir Putin had his own adult daughter inoculated with that vaccine. What would you say about whether or not that vaccine that they claim to have produced is ready?
Yeah, that's really challenging because they haven't released any information about their clinical trials for those vaccines. In the U.S. and in other countries, we do that, right? As we go through those clinical trials, we publish reports on what we've learned about that clinical trial, whether it's phase one, phase two, or phase three. They haven't done that yet. So we can't say the efficacy of that vaccine. We don't know what that is yet.
Are you worried that a vaccine could come out, but enough people choose not to get it, either because of misinformation or misconceptions? Could that have a significant impact?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, the best example of something like that occurring is with the flu vaccine every year. We've done plenty of studies around the flu vaccine, and people say, well, it doesn't work anyway, or I get the flu from the flu vaccine. Right. And those simply aren't the case. You can't get the flu from the flu vaccine. We've known that. We've studied that. There's lots of data out there supporting that. That can't occur. Efficacy of the vaccine itself is definitely a challenge because it takes a long time. It takes up to maybe 6 months to produce enough vaccine for the flu. And if that virus mutates, which they do, any mutation from when the vaccine was created to the time you got the vaccine itself, it's not going to be as effective. It's not zero, but it's maybe not 100% effective to where we'd like it to be. So people don't get vaccinated because of those reasons, and they have a mistrust in the science of it. So there's going to be some of that. But in the U.S., we are scrutinizing these vaccines every step of the way to ensure they're the safest possible vaccine for the population that's going to work.
Got just a little bit of time left, enough to get to this voicemail and a response from Joanne. This one's from Stephanie. Let's listen.
Hi, this is Stephanie from Indianapolis. I'm a retired journalist, and this conversation is reminding me of an investigative series I did many years ago where I came across the term non-falsifiable hypothesis. And that is basically, if you can't prove what I say isn't true, then it's true. And that's a pretty hard thing to dissuade somebody of believing.
Joanne, what do we know about this idea of a non-falsifiable hypothesis?
Absolutely. This notion that you, one, non-falsifiable in the sense that any information that you give me that would be sort of counter to your argument or your hypothesis is always sort of turned around, again, being an argument that actually is in favor of the hypothesis. But the other thing that Stephanie mentioned is also important here is it's difficult to prove a negative. In fact, it's difficult for scientists to prove, for example, that the vaccine has no side effects or is safe. In a sense that safe means nothing happened, nothing bad happens. And so any little sort of tangible, oh, look what happened in this one particular anecdotal case, is a tangible thing that can be turned around to say, look, this is what they're hiding from us. And that becomes a challenge to both attempting to debunk the misinformation and communicate the safety.
I want to thank our guests for taking the time today. This has been a great discussion. Tom Tuczynski is Director of Epidemiology Education at the Richard M. Fairbanks School of Public Health at IUPUI. Thanks for coming back, Tom.
Thank you, Matt.
And Joanne Miller is Associate Professor of Political Science and International Relations at the University of Delaware. Great info today, Joanne. Thanks.
Thank you, Matt. Thanks for having me.
Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Maggie Galon. Scott Cameron's our managing editor. Adam Gross is our technical director. I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening. This is All In.